Today on Coding 101, we have the creator of IPTV and more. Stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Coding 101 is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want, when you want, with access to over 2,400 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit Lynda.com/C101. That's Lynda.com/C101. And by Hover.com. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. It's simple, honest, and easy to use. For 10% off your first purchase, go to Hover.com and enter promo code C101. Welcome to Coding 101. It's the show where we introduce you to the world of the Code Monkey. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I'm Shannon Morrison. For the next 30 minutes, we are going to get you all learned up on what you can be with your programming knowledge.
That's right. Now, Shannon, you may remember, we always have to remind the audience, this is not a regular episode, right?
That's right. It's not. So we usually have an 8-episode module where we talk you through a certain type of language, a programming language. Between those, we're going to do 2 episodes where we interview really cool people that are in programming, that do some kind of programming for their life. This is what they do as
exactly. And it's just a nice way to remind people that we're not just throwing code knowledge into your head. There's light at the end of the tunnel. And these people are that light. Now, speaking of the light, we want to welcome to the show Mr. Carl Auerbach. Carl, so thank you so very much for coming on. I know you're a busy man. We've had you on several TWiT shows before, including This Week in Enterprise Tech. You may be a little bit of a man of mystery to many people out on the internet, but whether or not they realize it, you probably created something they're using, yeah?
Oh, almost certainly.
Yeah. Now, Carl, okay.
I am intrigued.
I'm going to ease you into this because I think the Code Monkeys are going to love knowing who you are. But let's start with something very simple, which is, how did you get into coding? How did you get into computers? How did you get into the IT revolution? You've been around for a while, including a time before the internet. So how did you get to where you are now?
Well, I was one of the infamous members of the UCLA Computer Club in 1968, next to IMP number 1. And I set forth to learn basic programming. And my first language then was PL1. And it was a simple program. It took me a year to get my first piece of code running. And, of course, then it was on card decks, submit them, and things like that. I happened to be also right next to right next to the Transportation Institute, where we're doing early car crashes. And I was hired as a film scanner, which has had these machines where we're watching cars getting off freeways from helicopters, and we're punching cards showing coordinates, and then they had a big program that would use those. So I had an IBM 7094 to myself whenever I wanted. So I set forth to learn how to use that. So I wrote some trivial programs then, and up and bigger and greater things since then.
Now, the mention of those systems are probably bringing some bad flashbacks to the older programmers.
Or for me, I'm going, what
is that? What is that? Yeah, blinky boxes with switches. You actually have with you a piece of gear from one of those early computers.
This wasn't that early. This was from the 80s, or 70s, I mean, a PDP 1170 console.
Oh, my gosh. There it is in front of you. All sorts of memories.
And I used to load in the boot codes into this thing and load it into memory and get the thing going.
Well, actually,
you could tell a lot from these lights. You could tell whether your program was idling, whether it was in supervisor mode, what part of memory it was in. You could get a lot of useful data by watching those lights.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because in our first module, we did a binary to decimal conversion.
Right.
And there were people who were like, well, why would I need to know binary? Well, it's because the old programmers, that's how we programmed. You didn't have a keyboard. You had to flip switches, and then you committed it to memory. Could you actually show us what you would typically do for a sequence?
Well, most of the time we did the boot sequence, which I can't remember the codes, but it was something like this. And you'd store one of these switches went up to store things in memory, and then you'd finally hit the go button, which would cause it to jump to that location, which would begin to bring the system up. And that system back, by the way, ran this was Unix.
Wow.
Well before DOS ever came out from Microsoft. Right. So Microsoft went backwards because we had multi-user operating systems before DOS even came out.
And here we're still using a lot of basics of Unix.
Oh, yeah. Well, is it Carl, because you know, one of the things that often fascinates the new generation of code monkeys is when they start stepping back a little bit and they realize that a lot of the things that they're learning that they just take for granted actually have a backing. There's a reason why programming works the way it does, and that's because we're basing it off of the first generation of computers. We see that a lot. We see that in learning binary. We see that in learning hexadecimal. We see that because that's how you originally had to program these computers. Now, okay, now let's step back from that because...
Well, I was going to raise the point that most people today don't even know the difference between one complement's arithmetic and two's complement arithmetic.
Wait, what's the difference?
And that's kind of important.
I don't know what's the difference.
Well, we'll get to that in just a little bit. No, but Carl... It's good that you're a geek. It's good that you're an old-fashioned geek. It's good that you were really at the cusp, the start of the IT generation. But that's not...
Oh, I'm a long way from it.
Yeah, well, yeah, but that's not all. That's not the only reason why we brought you on, right? Because you actually have a lot of experience with things that are not just hacking together computers. You're on the board of directors for the Open Voting Consortium. You're a member of the intellectual property section of the Cal State Bar. You are a co-founder for the Boston Working Group. You are part of the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. And you're on ICANN. So you are...
I affiliate with ICANN. I was on the board of directors. Most of these are past sort of things, but I'm doing new and greater things. But going back to first generation coding, can't forget that the first programmers were doing the ENIAC machine and the Sage computers, and those were almost exclusively women.
Yes. Go women!
But with all this experience, with all this influence that you've had on the internet, you've seen it change a lot over the years, right? I mean, this used to, it was a geek project at first, but how have you seen it evolve?
Well, when I first came across the internet, there was no word for it, but it was a collection of communications vehicles for us to do exchanging basic applications, email, file transfers, things like that. And we got pretty much down and dirty with the hardware, modems and wires and what have you. It's evolved a lot since then, but the first 15, 20 years of the internet were largely people playing around with not a lot of restrictions. What's happened and scares me the most recently are the changes of the legal environment around the internet, the restrictions that are arising, and the transformation of the internet into a utility. And we're not clear whether it's a utility or a vehicle for innovation anymore. Same thing has happened in programming. We're starting to see in programming used to be a Wild West thing, or anybody could write a piece of code. But we're getting to the point where not anybody is going to be able to write code for, say, the braking system in a self-driving car. You're going to need some pretty stringent tests on that code. Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to that. But before that, I think Snubs had a question about something I was talking to her about before the show, and she got really excited by it.
I did. So I know that you were one of the creators of IPTV, and that's what we're doing now. This is the basis of what we have created our careers around. So I got really excited about it myself. And you were also one of the first paid employees of Precept Software before it was acquired by Cisco. So I want to know from you, how do you feel IPTV has changed since the late 1990s?
I've been unpaid early employee of several startups. I think I've done like 6 or 7. And if you want to make billions of dollars, you go to the places I turned down. But IPTV was part of Precept Software. That was a startup done by Judy Estrin in 1995. She brought me in with Steve Kasner and Chachi Kwan and her sister, Deborah Estrin. And we gathered together one evening and said, what should we do? Should we do IPv6? Should we do this or that? Should we do multimedia? We said, multimedia, that sounds like a lot of fun. Well, Steve Kasner had spent a long time at USCISI. He was part of the team that sent the van out in the, I guess, the 1960s and 70s, doing the first internet voice projects, mobile voice. So he was also the inventor of the RTP, one of the co-inventors of the RTP-RTCP protocols. So we took that, bound it up with IP multicast. There was a model already put together by Van Jacobsen on the internet, which was, I can't remember the name of it. It was what the IETF used for sharing, doing low-level videos and things like that. So we decided to start commercializing, building that up and commercializing it. So what I did at this company is Steve handled all the real-time algorithms, the how do you synchronize lip sync? Lip sync is really, really hard to do, especially when you have multiple streams. And I did the RTP-RTCP code, which was a heavily multi, well, not necessarily multi-threaded, but heavily asynchronous piece of C++ code that handled multiple media streams, handled the synchronization, handled the handoffs to the codecs, all that sort of thing. We put that together into a commercial product and made it work.
Wow.
Now, Carl, it's amazing because, you know, something that we are taking for granted right now, the fact that we can reach people, it's something that, when you think about it, at some point, a bunch of geeks had to sit around and say, I wonder what would be the best way to do this. I wonder how we could push this over networks. And even though it's simple now, we say, oh, yeah, just install this plugin.
It's not simple now.
Exactly. Well, yeah, but it seems simple because there are so many different products that we can use. At some point, you go back far enough, and it's you. It's you and a bunch of other people sitting around saying, let's solve the issues inherent
Let's do this thing.
In pushing
video. Well, do you know
video.
Simon Hackett? Do you
I
know
do.
Simon
yes,
Hackett?
Yes, yes.
Interop? Yeah. Well, I used to work with him. He used to be affiliated indirectly with TGV here in Santa Cruz. And he put together all kinds of fun things. He was in Adelaide most of the time. And he set up the remote jukebox. So we had a jukebox of a couple hundred CDs here in Santa Cruz. He set up a protocol to control it and to stream radio stations and music between Santa Cruz and Australia. So he could sit in Australia and listen to KPIG, which is a local Santa Cruz station, or vice versa. He could also change our volume and things like that. So we were doing multimedia stuff way back in the early, this was about mid-80s, thereabouts. He also went on to say, let's move voice over Ethernet and put together the first Ether phones I'd seen. And there was a T-shirt made with a remake of the painting from the Sistine Chapel, and God was handing off a mobile phone to Adam. Also, Simon went on to build one of the first internet toasters and several other tools.
Oh, that's serious work now.
That's great.
Serious work. Now, Carl, if you hold on for a second, ladies and gentlemen, we are with Carl Auerbach of Interworking Labs. He was a geek way before being a geek was cool. But before we get back to that interview, Shannon, Carl is a wealth of knowledge. He is a wealth of experience on the internet. I'm wondering if maybe you could tell us a little something about maybe another repository of knowledge that we could find on the internet.
I might. You've probably heard of it. There's a website online called lynda.com where you can find thousands and thousands of video tutorials about everything from programming to doing Photoshop to creating your own website if you wanted to. So our first sponsor for this episode is lynda.com. Lynda.com is the place where you can learn and you can keep up to date with your software. You can pick up new, brand new skills of anything that you want to, or you can explore new hobbies with their easy to follow video tutorials. Whether you want to master the fundamentals of programming, or you want to learn new programming languages like Python, or you want to build your own first iOS app, lynda.com offers thousands of courses in a variety of topics. At lynda.com, you can explore programming fundamentals. You can get started in everything from databases and object-oriented design to code efficiency and test-driven development. They also offer a brand new course on the new features of Java SE 8 and Foundations of Programming. This is pretty cool. It's called Programming for Kids. So this teaches kids to program using techniques, apps, and hardware. And I feel like this is so important for our educational process, especially here in America. I want to see kids growing up knowing how to code. And I love the fact that lynda.com is offering this kind of tutorials for these kids. There are over 2,400 courses, more added every single week, so you're never going to run out of something to watch. There's always going to be something that you can learn. And all lynda.com courses are produced at the highest quality, not like homemade videos on YouTube with, you know, a terrible webcam from the early 2000s and no mic. Lynda.com works with software companies to provide you updated training, and it's on the same day that new versions hit the market, so you'll always have the very latest skills. And at Lynda.com, the instructors, they're accomplished professionals. They are at the top of their fields, and they are passionate about teaching. I mean, just look at him. He looks so interested. I love it. I love watching people that get so interested in what they are doing. And of course, courses are all experience levels. So you can start with beginner, you can do intermediate levels, you can do advanced levels if you wanted to, and you can watch those on your computer, tablet, or your mobile device, whether you have 15 minutes or 15 hours. Each course is structured, so you can start wherever you want, and you can finish whenever you want. You can also search transcripts to find quick answers, or so you can read along with the video in case you feel like you missed something. You could skip ahead and be like, okay, where was that part that he said this thing? Lynda.com also offers certificates of completion when you finish your course, which you can publish on your LinkedIn profile, which is a really great way to get an awesome job in that company that you are so interested in. Now, it's only $25 a month, so go get it right now for access to the entire Lynda.com course library. Or for $37.50 a month, you can subscribe to the premium plan, which includes exercise files that let you follow along with the instructor's project using the exact same project assets that they do. Super, super cool. You can download everything that you need and you can just follow along. It's very simple. And you can try Lynda.com free. For a 7-day free trial, visit lynda.com/C101 to access the entire library. That's over 2,400 courses. So go get it now, free for 7 days. That's lynda.com/C101. And of course, we thank lynda.com for their wonderful support of our show right here on TWIT. Thank you.
We're back with Carl Auerbach of Interworking Labs. He's really one of the fathers of the useful internet.
He's quite an interesting character, I'd say.
I don't know. No, I've known Carl for a while. I've worked with Carl. We're both part of the Interop network, mm-hmm. which is it was a lot of fun, especially in the early days where you were playing around with protocols. Now, Carl, I want to ask you this. It's one thing to be a geek. But you've been very active. I dare say you've been politically active, and you definitely have some strong feelings about what the internet is supposed to be, what it's supposed to represent, and how it should develop. And I think we could see that in the boards that you've been on, and everything from the IETF to ICANN. You've always taken a stance of we want the internet to be more than just information sharing. We want for it to be more of a community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the internet is based on commercial things, but its real value is the fact that we can all communicate with each other with relatively open channels and with not a lot of money. The one thing I always hearken back to is about 1928, there was this, the telephones, those old carbon microphone things, you'd see people screaming into it, you know, hold the presses in all the old movies. Because they had terrible microphones. Well, somebody invented a plastic hand. Here would be the kind of the microphone, and they put this plastic widget around it, and they'd start yelling into it. And that was called a hushaphone. What its purpose was to sort of focus the sound into the microphone and keep other people from hearing you screaming into the microphone. Well, several years later, 1948, some AT&T guy, remember Ma Bell AT&T, the great monopoly, TPC, the phone company, they saw this thing. And they said, oh, my God, we can't have somebody building add-ons to the telephone network. This is going to sound real familiar to what's going on with Comcast and net neutrality, things like that. Mm-hmm. So AT&T got the FCC to come along, the FCC being the technical body, that said, wow, this passive plastic device is going to cause operators to go deaf. It's going to electrocute linemen so they're blown off the telephone poles while they're working on circuits. Whoa. So they got this little widget banned. But the people who had this widget went along, just said no, and they went to the court. And it was a famous hushaphone case in like 1950, early 50s, that said, this is crazy. This thing is totally passive. There's got to be some trade-off between your private use of the utility and the public use. So they created a rule that you had the ability to make private use of these utilities as long as there wasn't a public detriment, and there was a balancing act. Well, that led eventually to the Carterphone case and the MCI case, the breakup of AT&T, and that was the thing that allowed the internet to evolve in the cracks that were opened up because AT&T's restrictive constraints on the telephone network were not there. AT&T in the 70s and 60s was very hard pushing on ISDN as that was going to be the network of the future. And the world would have been very different if that gone through. Well, the internet is suffering from the same thing right now, is we're getting tighter and tighter closure on what people are allowed to do. Like if you're a customer of most ISPs, you can't set up servers in your house. You have to go set up your servers in a cloud or some permanent place. And if you do get static IP addresses, they're usually expensive and there's bandwidth constraints, it's asymmetrical. We're being closed down. So I promulgated a rule based on the old Hushaphone case, which basically says that any private use of the internet is permissible as long as there's no significant public detriment. And I go on further to put the burden of proving that public detriment onto the person who is saying that your activity should be shut down. I've called this the first law of the internet. And it's my model and you can see it on the front of my website, cavebear.com. It's my model for what rules should guide use of the internet. We can't have unrestricted use, but it's got to have a strong bias towards open and liberal use. And those who want to shut a person down should have to carry the burden of shutting it down. And being a lawyer, I know the value of what it is, placing the burden on someone. It makes it very hard.
You've got Shannon here with her mouth agape because she's like, wait a minute. Oh, it's true. Duh, that makes sense. It's interesting that...
I was like... No way.
Yeah, exactly. Right. No, and the first rule of the internet. That was actually
awesome.
The title of one of our This Week in Enterprise Tech shows where Carl was a guest. It's amazing that the same utilities that were claiming that this technology and that technology was going to destroy this public utility, they're the same ones who now we could make an argument that they are doing things that are a detriment to public use.
I think
the first rule of the internet still holds.
Man, that's
a very useful book to look at, by the way, with related to the current thing with net neutrality and things, is to take a look at the old early 1900 book about the Southern Pacific Railroad called The Octopus. And it was about the Southern Pacific and California using rules to strangle farmers and essentially force them off their land.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little something else about some other activism, some internet activism that you were a part of.
Yeah, I know you were a part of... this lawsuit against ICANN because you wanted to see their financial records. Is that correct?
Well, it was my lawsuit. It wasn't actually a lawsuit. It was a motion to compel them. I was on the board of directors of ICANN. I was elected by the public. I was the only person ever to be elected by the public to the board of directors of ICANN, at least for North America. I represented 330 million people. I represent more people than the president.
They stopped doing that after you, right?
They erased my seat and that of four other publicly elected people because they hated the system so much because we were uppity and asked questions.
Good for you.
ICANN is a California corporation. California's corporation law says a director has, in the words of the statute, the absolute right. Air quotes are appropriate. Absolute right to inspect and copy the papers of the company. And you want that. You don't want a passive board of directors sitting around allowing another Enron or something like that. So I said, I want to look at the financials. I want to look at the general ledger. What's dangerous about that? And I want to see if we're paying bills that have invoices or we're just paying things or are we spending too much on stuff? You know, just the general business stuff. And they said, no. And I said, what do you mean, no? And they said, you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. I said, I'm on the board of directors. I have a fiduciary duty. I'm bound to protect the corporation no matter what. If you sign me a contract, you're shifting me over to contract law, which is a lower standard. That's a very legalistic argument, but it's an important one. And they insisted. So I sued. EFF backed me, and we went through and spent 18 months wrangling around. And then we got to the court, and the judge said, ICANN, you lose. Tell me why you shouldn't. And they were told to hand over the documents, and they eventually did. Over the years since, they've tried to whitewash and say they didn't lose, but they lost completely and absolutely, and they should have.
Well, Carl, here's the weird thing about that. Once they did turn over the records, it was no big deal, right? I mean, it's
stiff standard, typical stuff on a startup. They didn't have an employee handbook. They were overpaying their law firm. They were not tracking travel expenses very well. The standard kind of stuff that is not embarrassing, easily fixed.
It sounds like the same kind of stuff that I've dealt with startup companies, you know, things
every
that you just
startup.
Forget to charge for, or other things that you charge way too much for. It happens.
And what their response was, of course, to use the most expensive law firm in the world to pay for this stuff, where they could have bought a Nolo Press book and done the same thing for a couple hundred dollars.
But you're a dangerous combination. We talk a little bit about this on one of our other shows, This Week in Law, where you are a hardcore engineer. I mean, you know exactly how protocols work, how network works, how they're put together. But you also know law. And I think
I am an attorney.
That's very intimidating, right? I mean, because that combination doesn't really exist. Sometimes you have lawyers with technical knowledge. Sometimes you have engineer with legal knowledge. You're really both. You wear both hats at the same time.
Well, I've been named a fellow of law and technology at Caltech and Loyola Law School in Los Angeles.
Jesuit-run university, by the way.
I went to a Jesuit law school.
I think you just had to put that in there. Okay. I'm sorry. I that was off the track.
But I'm a troublemaker. In my family, it's an honor to be arrested for civil disobedience, and unfortunately, I've never actually been arrested for that.
I could fix that.
With the people that I generally hang out with, I go to DEF CON and things like that, I have to say, yeah, you know, I always question authority whenever it comes to any kind of rules that I'm supposed to follow. I'm always the person that raises my hand and asks,
well, one of my favorite phrases, in fact, my personal motto, is a phrase that I can't quote the Latin with you, but it says, the argument based on authority is the weakest of all arguments. And that comes from Thomas Aquinas.
Yes.
And I really like the notion of using an authority of the Catholic Church as an authority for the proposition that one should question authority.
I'm all actually, well, because Jesuits do that. That's kind of
awesome.
That's kind of our thing. So that's why we got suspended at one point. Well, actually not suspended. We got removed. We got eliminated. We were suppressed. But let's get past. Shannon mentioned DEF CON. Do you attend DEF CON at all?
Occasionally I go to the not to be named conference that's in Santa Cruz every December, but it conflicts with an intellectual property conference I also have to attend. So I haven't been to DEF CON, but I go to the other secret conference.
The elite conference.
Well, it's called the Think Conference.
Yeah.
Oh, Think. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And now you know what it is.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
It's like DEF CON on steroids with not as many unshowered people.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, it's definitely unshowered.
Are you one of them?
Well, it starts Friday afternoon and goes through Sunday afternoon. It's not a break.
Oh, wow.
Now, Carl, we do need to take a break. But when we come back, I want to talk to you about something that I know has been on your mind recently. I've seen it on your blog. I've seen it in your emails, specifically talking about programming, talking about this current generation of programmers and this current generation of electrical engineers. And the disconnect between the two, I think that's an important issue for anyone who's considering a career in anything IT, and I think you can give us a very unique perspective. Can you hang around for just a bit?
Of course.
Yeah. Now, we are all about good ideas. I mean, that's why we've got Carl on the show. That's why we've got Snubs and myself talking all about coding knowledge that we drop into your knowledge hole. But the question is, what do you do with that good idea? Hopefully you know that in order for a good idea to become a great idea, it needs to spread. It needs to undergo scrutiny. It needs to be seen by your peers, by people around the world. And in today's age, there's really no better way to do that than to publish a website, to publish a blog, to get the word out on the interwebs, the internets, those tubes that blow knowledge around the world. And folks, if you're going to do that, you got to work with Hover. Now, why do you want to work with Hover? You want to work with Hover because you'll get a secure domain name. You'll get something catchy and memorable to represent your online identity, your ideas. Hover gives you exactly what you need to get the job done. You'll find the perfect domain name for your idea so that you can get started working on it. And then you move on to the next thing on your to-do list. You don't obsess over getting that TLD that's just right. Now, people love Hover because when you're looking for the best place to register a domain name, you ask the people who know a lot about domains, and that's Hover. Geeks, developers, designers, programmers all love Hover because they know that they'll have the best tools and support. But you don't have to be an expert to get a domain. The service is simple enough to use that you'll be comfortable figuring it out by yourself, and the support team is always ready to give you a hand. Now, Hover takes all the hassle and friction out of registering a domain name. They give you easy-to-use, powerful tools to manage that domain, and they let you get that perfect domain names with top-level domains of their own. It's easy. All you have to do is search a few keywords, and Hover will show you the best available options and suggestions. Hover is a clean and simple website. In less than 5 minutes, you can find the domain name that you want and get it up and running. And they've got a huge variety of domain extensions, like, of course, .com and .net and country codes to best suit your needs. So you can get just about anything. Hover is honest. This is something that we prize on Twit. They don't believe in heavy-handed upselling or charging you for something that should just be there, part of your package. You'll get everything with your domain, no more, no less, including your custom email. You'll get a smart control panel so that you can do what you want to do with your domain with a click of a button. Plus, Whois Privacy is included free on every domain that supports it. If you ever needed a hand, Hover is also the best customer service support around. They're known for their no-wait, no-hold, no-transfer phone service. And when you call, how about this? You get an actual live person, not a bot, not a relay, not an email message. It's someone who can address your concerns in real time. Also, TLDs, you know how you always have to do that little name game where you're looking for something that someone else hasn't used? Don't do that anymore. Instead, why not use .club? Hover is constantly making new TLDs available for you, including brand new TLDs that just came out, like .club. These new TLDs make it a whole lot easier to get the domain name you really want, because a lot of them, as we know, are already taken in .com or .net or .org. You don't have to settle for something less than perfect by adding a dash or dropping a letter or adding a word like the or inc. Instead, just get .club. They're great for any kind of club or social group, country club, book club, sport club, even Facebook groups. There's so many different applications, and they're all available to you through Hover. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to visit Hover today to register your domain name and get 10% off your first purchase. Go to hover.com and use our promo code C101. That's hover.com, promo code C101. And we thank Hover for their support of Coding 101.
Guess what, Padre?
What?
I am interested in this.
Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. No, I can tell because you've got that serious face on.
Remember when I was a kid and I said that my dad taught me how to build computers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all he did. He never taught me about software.
Yeah. And you know what? This is actually something that I hear about a lot, which is someone says, I'm a hardware guy. Or mm-hmm. someone says, I'm a software guy.
Yeah. And I had to force myself to learn programming when I got into college. I took
exactly.
Java courses.
Exactly. And that's something that Carl... Actually, I think you're pretty passionate about it, right, Carl? Because, I mean, there's a whole generation of programmers out there who think that the hardware is just the generic stuff that my software runs on. Or you've got engineering guys, hardware guys, who think, well, software is just the stuff that kind of works on top of what I've created. But you take a different approach. You take a more integrated view.
Well, people who write code without knowing what's underneath them, that's fine for building once-off applications or something where you don't care about long-term performance or long-term reliability is not a concern. That's good for a lot of code. But if you really want to build something serious where you are concerned about performance and reliability and all the other aspects of my world's often embedded systems, so you have to know your context. And I started out with vacuum tubes, and I had to learn about triodes and grids and anodes and all that sort of stuff, pentodes, and all the differences between different vacuum tubes. So I had to learn to start from circuits, and I was really fascinated by how one took logic and put it together to form gates and then form stored programs to go between that, and the basic notions of program counters, stepping through, and that sort of stuff. But today's world, if you're writing a piece of code that it's going to do anything other than trivial. You're going to get into the world of multi-threading. You're going to have pieces across the network. You're going to have to deal with a lot of asynchrony. And that means you've got to start learning about what's really happening underneath you. You can't simply point at a number space and increment it. Is that a safe operation or not? Do you have to put a lock around it? What is a lock? How much does locking cost? What kind of deadlocks can you get into? And if you get deeper into systems like I am down in kernels, you've got to worry about interrupts, like I'm worrying about interrupt affinity. Which CPU am I on? Which cache am I blowing away when I switch between one core and another? If you want to build serious code, you've got to know that stuff. And also, you've got to know what your language is doing underneath you, like Python. You don't really have much control over when an object goes away and whenever code is bound to the object destruction happens. That's why for real-time systems, I prefer C++ because I control that sort of stuff. But again, you You've got to know what's going on. I mentioned earlier, one's complement arithmetic, two's complement. One's complement is mostly dead these days, but it's still alive in the internet checksum. And you've got to know that there are, like, for example, in one's complement, two kinds of zeros. There's a positive zero and negative zero. Two's complement has its own strange things at the endpoints. You've got to know what happens when number spaces wrap around. We do software testing in my company, Interworking Labs. And rather than doing fuzz testing where we test every possibility of an input to a piece of code, we know that people always screw up places where the sign bit or lack of a sign bit rolls over. Or where, so you always look at, you know, the magic numbers, every power of two you look at, and you run tests right around that point because you know somebody has screwed up. People are really sloppy in C-type languages about the unsigned versus signed integer types. You just got to know how all this maps into a computer. Most people don't.
Carl, you are the CTO of Interworking Labs, which was the first company that specifically tried to test protocols and in the interworking of protocols and networks. And you developed software like the Maxwell series that allowed you to create virtual networks and see how different applications and different protocols would interact. So, of course, you are deeply involved with both the software, the way it's written, the code that goes into the software, mm-hmm. and the hardware that software runs on. I'm wondering is this a symptom of the death of the generalist? I mean, we seem to be getting so specialized these days that there are very few people who are willing to become an expert on multiple things. They want their thing that they do, and then they hand off responsibility to somebody else, and they don't need to worry about how it interacts with, say, the hardware abstraction layer.
You've got to be a generalist. Somebody has to be a generalist, and everybody needs to know something about general things. We were down at Florida last year for the robotics thing, the DARPA
yes,
test.
Awesome.
And I was talking to one person there who is highly concerned. They're dealing with robots that are balancing. So they've got to have extremely fast reaction time between their processors to the motors that are effectuating mechanical control. And he was worrying about cache misses. And he had gone away from AMD processors because they had sort of uncertainties in cache refreshing to Intel-type processors because they had more certainty on their caching. Those kind of delays mattered to him. I'm right now fooling around with just today, I discovered a bug in one of our codes. It was just being highly unstable when I was delaying packets for between 95 and 105 milliseconds. Any other value? Fine. And I dug and dug and dug. I found out the Linux kernel people are going towards tickless kernels because ticking costs. Interrupts are expensive. You blow away caches. They burn power. All kinds of bad things. So they're moving towards tickless kernels. Well, for my application, I really need high time resolution, and I want those ticks. So I had to dig deep, 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 and found out that the Linux kernel people had changed the setting that turned my kernel into a ticking kernel. And so I had to go back in and build some new kernels today that started ticking again and fix the problem. But you've really got to dig deep to find that sort of stuff, and generalists aren't going to see that.
Now, we do have to wrap up pretty soon. But before we do, I did want to ask you a question for our Coding 101 audience. We have a chat room going on throughout the day, and we always get a lot of questions through there. And a lot of them are the same as me. They're not advanced coders, and they have a lot of questions. So I want to ask you, what kind of opportunities could you do, or what kind of answers could you give to a new coder to tell them that, yes, there is something more than just learning this code? You can get a career out of it. Where would they go from just the beginning?
Well, about several years ago, I made the prediction that coding is going to become a lot like auto mechanics, that a lot of people are going to end up getting boring jobs working on Chevys, coding equivalent working on a Chevy. But there's only going to be a few people who are going to be lucky enough to be the Ferrari race car mechanics. And that's still true today. You've got to start reaching out. You've got to get away from simple web-based programming. If you're living in a JavaScript world with RESTful interfaces and stuff, you're in the past. You really want to my mind, the interesting areas are getting into robotics where you're dealing with the real-time aspects, getting into high availability systems or highly trustable systems that are going to be needed for it's like self-driving cars or anything else that's automated that has a health factor in it. moving towards more expert systems. We have a long way to go as to make systems more and more quasi-intelligent. That's, I think, where programming gets fun. I've always been heavily involved. I like seeing things move. I like touching a piece of code and seeing something mechanically move. To me, that's fascinating. But you've got to reach out and find environments in which to do that sort of thing. Fortunately, you can do it yourself in your home lab, but people tend not to challenge themselves. You've got to work with others to make that happen.
It's very true.
Carl Auerbach, Interworking Labs, good friend of the Twit TV network and absolute friend of the interwebs. I want to thank you so very much for being our special guest on this wild card episode of Coding 101. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find out more about you? And of course, they're going to go to the Wikipedia. They're going to find your entry there. That's fascinating. But if they want to find
it.
It's, you know, we're going to fill it out a little bit. I was going
to Wikipedia. You can't talk about yourself. Other people have to talk about you.
We'll do. Hey, let's do the
Code. I'm still waiting for my Wikipedia. Okay.
Code Monkeys. I want you to go over to Carl Auerbach's Wikipedia page and fill in the blanks because it's just giving you bare bones. Let's throw them some love. But Carl, aside from the fact that they need to look up Interworking Labs if they have anything to do with
CaveBear.com
and CaveBear.com, where can they find you?
And historyofTheInternet.org.
Tell us a little bit about that project, because that's a fascinating project.
What we're trying to do is, before the people who were there die, we are trying to interview hundreds of people who were involved in the creation of the Internet from around 1965 to 1995. We're trying to get this all down. We're going to edit it into a story. We're going to edit it into about 200 YouTube episodes. But we're taking all the raw takes and we're publishing those under Creative Commons or public domain so that we can create an archive for historians of the future to dig into and find out what actually happened with the Internet. Because it's not a story of one or two gods creating the Internet. There was hundreds and hundreds of people involved. There were lots of ideas, many of which worked, many of which didn't go anywhere, many of which evolved. There's a lot of loose ends that are still out there to be picked up and used for very valuable loose ends. It's a history of ideas and how people fought over those ideas. It's a lot like how Gutenberg was given for the credit for inventing the printing press, but there was all these other people around, people who did paper and ink and published books and distributed the books. And we're trying to get that whole synoptic story recorded in so for the future.
Carl, thank you. Thank you so very much. And we look forward to seeing what you have next. Now, folks, this is the end, unfortunately, of Coding 101, this episode, this wild card episode. We will be back next week teaching our newest programming module, which is Perl, along with our code warrior, Patrick Delahanty. Till then, what we need you to do is to go ahead and drop by our show notes page. You can find us at twit.tv/coding. And there you'll find not just all of our episodes, but you'll also find the links to the GitHub repository where you can find the actual code we used during our shows. Now, it's not just at twit.tv. Where else can they find us, Shannon?
We're also on iTunes. So if you search for Coding 101 over in iTunes, you'll find all of our different RSS feeds in there. Please do subscribe and let all your friends know about the show and tell them to download it and check it out, especially if they're interested in learning to code and they just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah, help us get our iTunes mojo back. You can also find us at our G Plus page. Actually, this is the place that you want to go.
Yes.
Find us, gplus.to/twitcoding101. It is a fantastic place for you to join. Over 1,000 members now. And no matter what level of programmer you might be, beginner, intermediate, advanced, there's something for you. If you are a brand new person, brand new geek to coding, you'll find people who can help you. If you're intermediate, you can have people who actually point you into projects you should be doing. And if you're advanced, we need you because you need to help us teach the next generation of code monkeys.
There's been a few times where I have tried some audience their own code on my own computer, and I say, "Oh, well, why didn't this thing work?" And they're quick to answer it. They just hop in there to the Google Plus community and answer right away.
Right.
Also, if you're not interested in Google Plus, we're also on Twitter, myself and Padre SJ. So if you want to check us out over there, we're constantly answering questions on our Twitters. I'm at Snubs.
And I'm at Padre SJ. Also, you're going to find us online live every Thursday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. Actually, not the next two Thursdays, but most Thursdays you're going to find us live here at live.twit.tv. She's getting married, and I'm marrying other people, which is weird, right? That's kind of symmetrical.
That's awesome.
I like that. But also, if you're going to join us live, why not jump into our chat room? You see how we pull questions right out of the people who interact with us during the show? Find that at irc.twit.tv. I think that's about it.
I think so. I think we're good.
So until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballister.
I'm Shannon Morse.
End of line.